this week's show, Man United pundits getting called out for being too close to Solskjaer, Bundesliga goes dark on an embarrassing day for ESPN+, the joyous return of football supporters as they return to stadiums in England, latest news from Disney Plus and CBS All Access for soccer fans, plus we have letters for the listeners in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host Kartik Krishnayar. If you're new to the podcast, we're your weekly guide to getting the best out of soccer viewing options from around the world. We often talk about some of the highlights and some of the things to look forward to and some of the news that will definitely enrich your soccer viewing experience. Now, Kartik, it's been an eventful week around the world. I mean, from everything last weekend, from MLS playoff games to, of course, title races, relegation battles, of course, the Champions League, Copa Libertadores, Europa League, and a whole bunch of other games from around the world. But anything in particular that stood out for you? Anything that was kind of your highlight or your most exciting 90 minutes?
Yeah, I think the 180 minutes of the Chivas León two-leg tie was pretty exciting in Liga MX, and we had one of the legs actually on NBCSN, which was a nice, pleasant surprise.
In English,
that might even been last week. Now I'm trying to. There's been so much football.
Yeah, it was like last Wednesday. In English.
The second leg was on Saturday night. So I think that was memorable for me. Those two legs, and then I would also say really enjoyed the Bayern Leipzig match. That and having Steve Cherundolo on co-commentary in American for such a big match in European football was really cool. He paired with Phil Bonney on that match. And I would also say that I was really impressed today with CBS with the Golazzo show around Europa League, which featured Rafa Honigstein in addition to Gus Poyet and Nico Kantor. I think this format is best for Europa League. It's better for Europa League than it is for Champions League. And there were so many in Champions League, once again, 15 out of the 16 teams that advanced to the knockout stage were from the big five leagues, right? Mm-hmm. And it just seems too predictable. Yeah, there are some dramatic moments, right? Inter and Shakhtar, either one gets a goal, they go through. Neither can get a goal. So there were some dramatic moments. But I really think that today, with Europa League, final match day of the group stage, and lots of tight groups, particularly for between second and third. And remember, third place in Europa League as of still this year, this competition is out of Europe completely. There was a lot of dramatic games. So really enjoyed that and thought the energy we've had from Nico Kantor and Gus Poyet got channeled even stronger today. And Honigstein being in the studio helped as well.
Yeah, for me, my favorite, my best game that I saw was RB Leipzig against Man United, a 3-2 game to Leipzig, really kind of a back and forth game. And for a while, it looked like this was going to be almost a Southampton against Manchester United, with Man United coming back to either equalize in this game or to win it at the end. And they had I think it was Bruno Fernandes's free kick hit the crossbar. They came close on a number of occasions. But it was an exciting game. But the other thing I liked about this game, though, too, is that in previous years, when Manchester United have been knocked out of the Champions League, so whether that was on Turner Sports or whether that was on Fox Sports, and we've had quite a few of instances where Man United have been knocked out in the earlier rounds, what ends up happening is that when it goes back to the studio, or to the commentator, it's almost as if someone died. It's just like really, really like you can tell the energy levels are low. You can tell that they're really not excited because they were hoping that Man United would go through because they're still a box office team. They generate massive TV ratings. And in this game at the very end with Peter Drury and Jim Beglin commentating on it, I was really happy because at the end, final whistle, you could tell in Peter Drury's voice that he maintained that upbeat commentating. And he sounded excited. What a great game this was. I mean, obviously RB Leipzig, a massive accomplishment here against the odds, against a team. Yeah, Man United definitely going through some rough times. Inconsistent probably is the best word. but crashing out of Europe, and it wasn't a downbeat, dour kind of, you mean 2 or 3 minutes after the final whistle. Having said that, though, Kartik, I missed this, so I want you to set it up. But from what I understand on ESPNFC this week, Craig Burley had some pointed criticisms to give about analysts that are in the game, whether they're in the UK or the US. But I'm wondering if you can give, for those who missed it, myself included, some backstory, and then whether you agree with Craig or not.
Yeah, so Craig Burley was talking specifically about kind of the, I would say, the bro culture of Man United former players in the media in the UK. And he's talked about this before. He talked about it a year ago when Solskjaer seemed to be getting less scrutiny than Mourinho or Van Gaal or Moyes did. And that the agenda was really set by some of the former Manchester United players who would duck away from talking about the situation, or cast blame on Ed Woodward, cast blame on Paul Pogba, whoever else, but defend Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Now, ironically enough, Craig Burley brings it up again on Tuesday night on ESPNFC, and I don't know if Craig had actually seen what had happened on CBS earlier, probably, well, they do it at 7 at ESPNFC, so what had happened on CBS at about 5:20. Eastern time, when we're talking Eastern time now, when Kate Abdo asked a perfectly innocent question to Peter Schmeichel, another one of those former Manchester United players, former teammate of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and of course, Solskjaer scored the winning goal in Schmeichel's last match as a Man United player, as we know, Champions League final in 1999. And Schmeichel was disgusted with the question, was visibly disgusted, started to dance around. And then when Kate tried to redirect and in a very good-natured way, ask him, well, but Peter, obviously the results are this, and he got snippy. He said, don't cut me off, I'm still talking, or something along those lines, and proceeded to give this defense of Solskjaer and this kind of attack on everybody else. So he inherited a bad lot from Mourinho. Ed Woodward isn't doing a great job. There's a cultural problem with the club that predates him, all of that sort of stuff. Now, I'm very neutral on the Solskjaer issue. I actually think Solskjaer has done a pretty good job in certain big matches. He beat Pep Guardiola 3 times last year, for instance. And you see the rallying effect he seems to have after halftime at Southampton, who I think listeners of this podcast know I rate as a top 6, top 7 team in England this season, and at West Ham. In this match, he was outdone by Nagelsmann, which, by the way, to your point about Drury and Beglin, they were the right they're usually the right commentators, right, mm-hmm. for these sort of occasions, but especially this, because it seemed like both of them understood Nagelsmann's tactics and how Nagelsmann had set up the team and what he wanted to do versus United better than most people you'd pull out of the UK would know, right? They clearly had watched a lot of Leipzig and understood how the team has progressed without Timo Werner this season. So anyway, but back to the overall point. So Burley, about an hour later, calls it out on ESPNFC that there's this culture in the UK to not discuss Solskjaer, and because there's so much influence of former Man United players in the British media, which we know is the case, that he's not getting the kind of criticism that he should be getting, and he's not getting the sort, he's not being judged by the same standard Mourinho, Van Gaal, and Moyes were. I tweet about it within seconds of watching ESPNFC, and I guess it started a firestorm. Everybody's in their camp, right? There are people who don't like Solskjaer, and there are people who do like him, and they're debating on those merits. They're not actually debating on the merit of what Burley said and what I was reiterating and what we saw from Schmeichel, which is there is this culture of former players who don't want to criticize a mate of theirs. And that's a very dangerous thing in soccer/football media, Chris. To Craig Burley's credit, not only is he calling it out, he's one of the few former players who has had no problem calling out former teammates of him who become coaches or become executives who may not be doing such a good job. Unfortunately, all too often we see buddies pull punches, whether it's on this side of the Atlantic or in the UK, when their former teammates are involved.
It's interesting too, because I don't think this is as much of a US problem. It's more of a UK problem. So, for example, as you were talking, I was going through my head as far as which were which former Manchester United players are in prominent roles in the UK, UK media, television, you mean Sky Sports, BT Sport, etc. And the ones that come to mind are Gary Neville, Rio Ferdinand, Owen Hargreaves, Paul Scholes. I mean, it is one of those things that there's a reason that they hire these guys. I mean, yes, they're champions. Yes, they've accomplished a lot in their career. But also they know that Manchester United fans make up, especially in the UK, probably the majority of the soccer fans. If you had to take percentages, yes, Liverpool would be close, but then you've got the other clubs too. But Manchester United are the most popular club, English club in the Premier League in England. But then in the US, you don't get as much of that. I mean, you go through, say, even the ones that are European or from Europe that work for ESPN or for Fox Sports or for NBC Sports. You think of the two Robbies. I mean, Robbie Earle would have been, Port Vale and Wimbledon. Robbie Musto is Middlesbrough. The ESPN FC crew. I mean, Steve Nicol, Liverpool, of course. Craig Burley, Chelsea. Shaka Hislop, West Ham United and Newcastle United, Fox Sports, you look at them and you go, okay, Alexi Lalas, you mean Padova, you know, LA Galaxy, New York Metro Stars, and Jovan Karoski, Borussia Dortmund, and you go down the list stateside, and it is more diverse as far as the clubs. It's not like we have a, NYCFC crew and they seem to be everywhere. That doesn't happen over here, so we don't get to experience that. And even in the UK too, I think Craig Burley bringing this up is definitely a valid point about kind of the old boys club, where they're a little bit more guarded. They probably won't be saying some things that are in their mind. They'll be a little bit more careful about what they say. Maybe they want to continue having a ambassador role with a club, or they know that don't shake the boat too much, because that could cause issues, or that could be something that the press write about, and then all of a sudden it's Peter Schmeichel looking that he's criticizing Man United players. He wants to protect them a little bit because he wants to keep on good terms with the club. Yeah, it's interesting, Kartik. I mean, can you think of any other examples, or is it pretty much, I guess, Liverpool, right? I mean, you had Robbie Fowler, Jamie Carragher, Steve McManaman. There's probably a Liverpool.
Media fears. So
Michael Owen.
Yeah, John Barnes. There's, I think Liverpool's the same thing. And this was something Jose Mourinho, early in his second stint at Chelsea, complained about, that there were too many Liverpool and Man United men in the media. Now, ironically, he would go on to manage Man United. I think what we have in the UK media is a lot of writers who are West Ham or Tottenham fans. I think there's a disproportionate number of fans of those two clubs who are football writers. But they are not... They're not prone to the same sort of biases as former players, who are brand ambassadors, as you said, trying to keep their own access. And I have to say also, the analysis of this match. So ESPN FC the night before, Don Hutchison was on. He's watched a lot of Leipzig the last few years. And Craig Burley was on, as usual. And Burley correctly pegged. He said even though United had won the leg at Old Trafford 5-0, there were large portions of that match where you saw Nagelsmann outthinking Solskjaer. Now, at home, with everything to play for, he kind of fancied the idea of Nagelsmann getting the better of Solskjaer. And that happened. So part of it was, you know, Burley saying, hey, that's right. You know, this the matchup between these two managers. I told you Nagelsmann would get the best of them, but no one else in the UK media wanted to acknowledge that. But yeah, the former player thing, I think it's Liverpool, Man United, maybe a lesser extent Arsenal, but they're not as many. I mean, Martin Keown and Lee Dixon, obviously Lee Dixon's doing more stuff now on U.S. television. I think it's really Liverpool and Man United, Chris, mm-hmm. which has created this. And I have to say, it also contributes to the victimization complex that I've dealt with people who follow me on Twitter know I've been dealing with this, the victimization complex so many Manchester City fans have, that you can't say anything slightly critical of Manchester City. They come after you, and it comes from having this sort of complex because your biggest rival is overrepresented in the media, and then now your year-in, year-out kind of title rival is overrepresented in the media. They're former players. So, but yeah, I the thing that I think was so important in this discussion this week, Chris, and the reason I highlighted it is I've heard Burley talk about this now for years, and then more specifically related to Solskjaer in the last year, year and a half. And he's right, and he's experienced it because as a former Chelsea player, if the listeners aren't aware of this, most of his teammates, in fact, one of them was Gus Poyet, who you see on CBS now, but Poyet went on to be a manager, Dennis Wise, Vialli, Steve Clark.
Hulett.
Hulett. Yeah, Zola, bunch of guys, right? Yeah. So he understands this, that he had an obligation as a media member to critique Zola and Poyet and Vialli's management. He just couldn't be mates with them if he was going to do the best job he could in the media. And so he's pointed this out for years. And I have believed him. I've known it's true. However, I had never seen it on full display until this week because it's never been on U.S. television. And we saw it with Peter Schmeichel. I give Kate Abdo all the credit in the world. She kept her composure. She was good-natured about it.
Right. I think she did her job.
Yeah, she did her job. She did a very good job. I think she knew what was going on. I think she knew why Schmeichel got defensive and realized, oh, okay, I triggered something. But
which is good though too, that she does that if she knows that, where if she, it's good television, right? It's putting someone on the edge, making them feel a little bit uncomfortable, getting them out of the comfort zone, and see how they really answer that question. And I'm sure from Schmeichel's point of view, that's probably his honest opinion, perhaps. And even though, you mean, it's not what we would expect from, say, more of a neutral analyst.
Yeah, I'm not sure if she knew how he was going to react when she asked the question. I think then once he got angry, she realized, oh, yeah, this is why. So, or once he got evasive, and then I'm gonna interrupt and try and get it out of him,
right,
which was really good. So she went up, her stock went up big time in my book this week. I mean, she does a good job, but this was, I thought, a really, really important moment for a presenter to hold it, to ask the question and then hold it together, and she did that.
And that's the thing, though, too. It's not that all Manchester United former players who are analysts are in this camp. A perfect example of this is Danny Higginbotham, who a lot of people kind of would think of Stoke City, but also former Manchester United player. And he's somebody that I'm not sure if you caught this past weekend, Kartik, but was in the analyst
Monday,
chair
yeah, Monday,
for,
yeah.
for NBC Sports on Monday. And finally, I think this was a really great boost for NBC Sports. They've been really, since Kyle Martino has left, they've been lacking that really, really good analyst to come in and really dissect things and really give us some enrichment and enlighten us in terms of some of the things that he sees that helps to accentuate the game that we watch. I mean, really, to me, I think he's the missing link. I think if you can bring in Higginbotham for the rest of the TV deal, which is like, what, this season and next season, with NBC Sports, I think that's a home run hit. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree, and I like how Ahmed Farid brought him in at the beginning of the show. I was not expecting it, and I knew he had relocated to the U.S., but I was not expecting it and happened to be watching, right? I don't always watch these pre-match shows, and just happened to be watching and was pretty excited. And it turned out he and Musto had a bit of a cadence already. They had a bit of a they had practiced in terms of their analysis. And the thing I really liked is that with Higginbotham on set in the post match show, we could criticize them for shifting to Paul Pogba after 10 minutes, right? But Ahmed Farid hosting, Robbie Musto flanked alongside Danny Higginbotham, there was a good 10-minute conversation about the match we had seen on Monday, which featured two non-Big Six sides and featured, you know, Brighton once again playing and Higginbotham said it at the outset, actually, on the pre-match show. Brighton, as I think I've said on this show a number of times, they've played so well. They play such good football, and they never get the results. And that happened again in this match. But they had a conversation, Chris, that they would not have had on previous Mondays when Higginbotham wasn't there and there were two non-Big Six teams playing. I think the conversation immediately would have turned to Pogba or what was going on at Liverpool or Jose Mourinho. They had a good 10-minute I would like them to spend the whole show dissecting the match we just saw, but that was a good kind of return to form for NBC. And you're right. Adding Higginbotham to the studio brings also a knowledge and a willingness to talk about non-Big Six sides and the different perspective and the kind of cutting-edge analysis that has been missing this year with Kyle Martino not there.
Yeah, let's hope we see more of him. He's been doing some work for CBS Sports HQ also, for the Champions League, some of the pre-game. So fingers crossed, hopefully NBC Sports makes the right decision there, because that's a great ad if they decide to keep on bringing him back. One more thing, Kartik, before we move on to the TV streaming news. And this was a rare instance where ESPN Plus completely dropped the ball. Last Saturday, Bundesliga, I mean, many of us tuning in around about the 9:30 mark Eastern time to watch some big games from the German league. And it was down. They had technical problems. There was zero communication on Twitter. People kind of guessing maybe it was weather related. But then there was one of the games, the Bielefeld game that was still playing.
Mainz game, yeah.
Right, exactly. And then championship games were working on ESPN Plus. Those were fine. And then probably about the, I think it was like about the 70th minute mark, it finally came back on. So for most, I mean, the vast majority of fans who wanted to watch the Bundesliga, we missed more than three quarters of those games. All of them are available on replay if you want to go back. But it's the live moments that we savor, we watch. And what a meltdown this was. Hopefully this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, a couple of things. We missed Llorena's fantastic goal that equalized for Dortmund live. And then the second thing is a little bit of a benefit for me was that I go on TalkSport regularly, usually on Sunday nights, U.S. time, Monday morning, early hours, U.K. time, to recap the championship. And I was able to tell the presenter this week, hey, I watched several championship matches in their entirety. I'm usually giving you analysis based on the highlights or what I've gone back and watched, but because the championship was the only soccer league working in its entirety on ESPN Plus, I actually watched like four championship matches start to finish this or most of the matches this weekend. So I was able to give better analysis maybe than I usually do when I go on UK radio. So that was a little benefit for me.
All right, so let's move on to TV streaming news, and I'll have you kick it off.
Yeah, so we're recording this on Thursday evening. We've just gotten done with the Disney Investor Day presentation. I think many of you probably have caught some of the highlights of this, but the big quick takeaways for me, 11.5 million ESPN Plus subscribers, which is a pretty big number for a sports-only streaming platform. There are going to be some changes to ESPN Plus, which include more written content, which there has been more written content now than there was a year ago, but more exclusive written content with your ESPN Plus subscription coming in 2021. There's going to be a deal with Comcast to add Disney Plus and ESPN Plus to Xfinity X1 in Q1. There is also going to be an ESPN Plus interface via Hulu sometime in 2021. I think they said in Q1. So that's going to be really cool. If you're logged into Hulu, it gives you, and you're an ESPN Plus subscriber, it gives you another kind of ramp to watch soccer, which is really, really, really outstanding. And another kind of all platform, all entertainment platform for where you can watch soccer, because obviously Peacock and CBS All Access have that currently, where you're in watching a movie or a television show or the news, and you can flip to a soccer match, which is something that maybe ESPN's a bit on the back foot with. So they'll build that into Hulu if you're an ESPN Plus subscriber, also with SportsCenter type show every morning for ESPN Plus. So some exciting news from ESPN Plus. One other quick note, 86.8 million Disney Plus subscribers, a quarter of which are in India. So maybe about 60 million or 62 million, something like that, in the U.S. But a huge number for Disney Plus. But they also acknowledge that they need more content, and they're producing more content, Marvel, Star Wars, Nat Geo stuff, to compete with the other streaming services, and also Discovery Plus, which will launch in Q1 2021.
Yeah, so CBS All Access is also trying to increase the number of subscribers they have, which actually they've been doing very well too, just as ESPN Plus has. And this week, CBS All Access announced that the app will be integrated into Comcast's Xfinity's X1 pay TV offering. And it's the first for Viacom CBS streaming service to be added to basically a cable box, right? So the benefit of this is that it really brings CBS All Access into more households. Xfinity has got massive numbers in terms of number of subscribers in the US. I believe it's still going to be kind of an add-on. You still have to pay for it, CBS All Access, but it's just a way to integrate that into your cable box so that you have your Netflix, you have your Comcast and those Comcast channels, and then also CBS All Access. So to make it more accessible for soccer fans, instead of going out of Comcast, going and then booting up a Roku or an Amazon Fire or whatever it may be, this will make it easier for soccer fans to watch more Champions League and Europa League, as well as NWSL. All right, Kartik, let's look at some of the TV ratings. Some big numbers coming out from this past week. We're getting to that stage of the season where there's playoffs, there's big Champions League games, etc. And we had the big number was almost 2 million viewers watched Club Lyon against Chivas on Univision on Saturday night. So 1.9 million people tuned in to watch that. And like you mentioned, Kartik, we've got the Liga MX playoff final, the first leg and second leg this weekend. The second leg, I believe, is Sunday. The other big number two was Barcelona against Juventus in the Champions League. This one also on Univision and TudoNA. This was the most watched UEFA Champions League group stage game ever on US television. And this was 1.07 million people watched this one on Tuesday during office hours, right? During the middle of the day. Some of the other numbers that jumped out to West Ham against Man United on NBC on Saturday, 882,000. And also a very big number from MLS, and that was Sporting KC last Thursday night on Fox, over there, Fox against Minnesota United. 851,000 viewers on that one, and that's one of the biggest numbers that they've had. Well, definitely the biggest number this season, and the biggest playoff number on Fox, I think, in about 22 seasons. So a massive number there. Anything else, Kartik, that jumps out at you, or any other perspective to add to that?
Yeah, that West Ham Man United number is a little disappointing, considering it was a Man United game on over-the-air television on NBC. I will admit I didn't watch a minute of it. I was watching Bayern Leipzig and had intended to switch back and forth, but was so absorbed by the match at the Allianz that I didn't switch back. And judging by my Twitter feed, the only people who were that I saw on my Twitter feed who were tweeting about the match were actually Man United fans. It felt like most neutrals in the U.S. were watching the Bayern Leipzig match. Now, again, we know that it's a very niche thing, and not many people. We just mentioned only 11.5 million ESPN Plus subscribers, and we know Bundesliga doesn't attract that many people. But I think the combination of Tyler Adams plus that matchup, and actually Chris Richards ended up playing, I think, right at the end of the match. Yeah. Kind of lent itself to more American fans maybe watching that match and hurting the NBC number for West Ham Man United.
I'm not so sure on that, though, too, because if you are on Twitter and looking at the Twitterverse, you would think that the Bundesliga and all the U.S. men's national team players that play in Europe, these numbers must be in the millions in terms of the viewing numbers. And then when we get the viewing numbers for the games that they're featured in, and yes, it's fantastic, it's exciting, everyone's talking about it, but then we look at the numbers, and the numbers are they're okay, but they're not through the roof. So I think again, that's kind of to me at least, is a little bit of the such a focus on Twitter where it's everyone's talking about it, right? Or mentioning goals, or you know, Weston McKennie's goal for Juventus. I mean, beautiful volley, gorgeous. But I don't think that's the reason that people are tuning in to watch Barcelona against Juventus on Univision. I think they're tuning in to watch what could be Messi and Ronaldo's last game on a major club tournament level that they're playing against each other. We don't know the next time they'll play each other. I mean, who knows when Barcelona will face Juventus in the Champions League again. But the other thing, Kartik, so looking at this weekend, definitely a big weekend around Europe. You've got the Madrid derby. You've got the South Wales derby, Cardiff against Swansea. You have, of course, the Liga MX playoff final. You have Manchester derby, right? Manchester City against Manchester United. And then you have the MLS Cup final, which are often this would have been so much better on a weekday, I think, rather than on a weeknight. But still, on a Saturday night, prime time, on over-the-air Fox, if you had to estimate, what's your educated guess of what this viewing number is going to be? And we'll talk about it in next week's podcast.
I'm actually surprised by that Sporting Minnesota number. But again, that was a Thursday night, right?
Thursday night football.
Right. So that's, I guess it's probably going to be low millions. I don't know. I have to admit, I'm more disconnected from the MLS and U.S. soccer scene than I've ever been. I haven't watched a minute of the playoffs. I'm not interested. I've just lost my interest in domestic club soccer
and I'm probably opposite for the first time in many years, where I've been watching more of the MLS playoffs.
I wasn't even aware that Seattle Minnesota game was going on until I woke up on Tuesday morning, 7 a.m. and had a press release from Minnesota United about them losing in the final. I thought in the conference final, I thought, hey, that's weird that it was a Monday night. I thought maybe it was in the middle of the week. I'm disconnected, so I don't know that I can approximate it. And this doesn't mean I'm permanently disconnected. I was angry about the COVID, the decision to send teams, traveling teams, and then all the COVID breakouts that we've had. And by the way, there have been much more COVID incidents in MLS and USL than there have been even in European leagues of late. So I feel my decision to not watch is kind of vindicated. But I'm not the person to ask this season about viewership, because I suppose all the normal people are viewing except for me. So maybe low 1.2 million or so, 1.3 million.
Yeah, it's a challenge, because for me personally, I'm not excited about Columbus Crew. I'm excited about Columbus Crew, the club, and how they were able to save the crew. And they're a decent side, but there's not many sexy players that I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to watch whoever it may be at Columbus Crew. I mean, I'm not a big Jesse Zardes fan. I know you have a lot more respect for him as a player than I do. On the other hand, you got Seattle, who are, you know, the best club in MLS and very predictably good. I mean, they keep on seeming to, in many years, most years, make it to the final of MLS Cup. So to me, it should be a pretty straightforward victory for Seattle Sounders. It might be a little bit tight in the beginning, but I mean, I think Seattle will win this. So my excitement level for this final is not that great. I'm not as excited. If this was a Minnesota against Nashville, which would not be good nationwide, I think. But for me, from a footballing point of view, in terms of the story of Nashville, you mean first season in, and the story of Minnesota United, kind of against the odds, you mean overcoming Sporting KC and then ultimately failing. But you mean if they had gone all the way, I think that would have been a more exciting story. So for me, my prediction on the English language side for Fox for the final is 750,000 viewers. Hopefully it's more than that, but we will have to wait and see, and we'll talk about it on next week's podcast, Kartik. But
doesn't Seattle alone have that many fans? Well, maybe not that many fans, but don't they alone have more fans than any other team?
It's up there, right? And even nationwide, I mean, Seattle does have a nationwide, a bit more of a national footprint, where there's fans nationwide that you know, enjoy watching Seattle play. Yeah, I mean, hopefully, yeah, it should be. I mean, it's primetime Saturday night. My estimation might be low, yours might be high, and we might find that it's right in the middle of that. But that's my prediction, is the 7:50 on that one. So it should be really interesting. Before we go into listener mailbag, Kartik, what's your must watch match this weekend? There's a lot to choose from, but anything that listeners should definitely watch?
Yeah, the Madrid Derby. I mean, I think we're on the cusp of Atleti potentially. And again, I knock on wood, because they never seem to win these matches, right, in La Liga. But then they did get the result against Barcelona a few weeks ago. We're on the cusp of Atleti potentially putting some distance between themselves and the other two big clubs in Spain in this season where we thought Cholo Simeone, this would be it for him, right? That his system had run its course. They've now got the new stadium. They've now spent money on some more attacking-oriented players. He didn't seem able to adjust his tactics last season to those players. Now Atleti is playing good football, good possession football at times, and also still playing the smart, strong defensive football they have. I think that they, in spite of their poor performance in Champions League, they got through, obviously, even though Salzburg had some chances in that match. They look like they're poised to win La Liga this season. So I would not miss this match. I think I know there are a lot of big matches this week, but I think this is far and away the biggest match. This match could decide the title in La Liga. Unbelievable that we're saying that in December. But I just feel like Atleti, I don't know if you agree with me, Chris, and you watch more La Liga than I do, but I just feel like Atleti is significantly better than the other two top teams in Spain this year. They've become much more pragmatic in how they play, and by pragmatic, I usually mean more defensive. When I say that, I mean more. They've now shown an ability to be able to hold the ball and keep the ball, and Simeone has been able to incorporate players with attacking flair into a system. So I think this could be it. If they win this match, that could be it.
Yeah, this is one of the worst Real Madrid sides probably in about a decade. I mean, they're that poor. I mean, really, just, I mean, you kind of think of the Galacticos and just how exciting and pulsating and attacking they are. This is the opposite of that. It's a pretty average team, really, in terms of the way that they're playing. And Atleti is really, really kind of picking up steam. Sociedad also in La Liga just doing so well, with a much smaller budget than some of these big clubs. For me, this weekend, it's tough. I mean, for me personally, the one I'm watching, looking forward to the most, is the South Wales Derby between Cardiff City and Swansea City, which will be live on ESPN Plus on Saturday morning. But the tough thing about derbies oftentimes is they don't live up to their hype. So for a Cardiff or a Swansea fan, this means everything. For a Real Madrid fan or an Atleti fan, this means everything. But oftentimes some of those derbies don't become as exciting as we hope they will, just because it's so tight, so tense, and there's so much on the line. For me, my must-watch match this weekend is on Peacock Premium. It's on Saturday. It's the last match of the Premier League Saturday, and it's Everton against Chelsea. Everton, who have massive holes in the back if defensively, but then I mean up front, I mean they seem to be scoring goals plenty, and then Chelsea, who are becoming more and more exciting to watch, and especially Olivier Giroud, who I think is really shining in a role where he's not getting as much playing time as he should. He deserves more. And this one for me is going to be a very fascinating game. Having said that too, you've got the Wolves against Aston Villa, another derby. I'm not sure what it is about this weekend, Kartik, with there being derbies around Europe. And then it seems to be always on the same weekend as the MLS Cup final. So there's definitely a lot of competition.
Yeah, and that's always a bad break for MLS, really, and people are burnt out from football by the time. And both the Manchester Derby and the Madrid Derby are on Saturday. One quick note about that Chelsea match and Giroud, since you mentioned him. I know this isn't a TV-related thought or media-related thought, but Giroud wants to stay in the France team as the number 9, and I think they need him. Deschamps needs him starting and playing regularly for the Euros this summer. So if Giroud is not starting regularly for Chelsea, he will probably force a move, whether it be on loan or that would see out his contract, actually. He would probably force a move in January. So I think it's also strategic for Lampard to keep playing him if he wants to keep him past January.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on to listener mailbag. First up is Molly DFW. She says, I started watching soccer when I met my fiance as she played the sport as a student at Lehigh University. A colleague at work turned me on to your podcast, and I listen every Thursday morning while I'm exercising at my gym before work. Through you guys, I have now been following Serie A, La Liga, Bundesliga, and Jenny and I have always followed the Premier League. Jen is a big Everton fan, and I support Arsenal. You guys bring a great perspective on how soccer is covered in television, being very fair. Keep up the great work. And that's something, Kartik, that we definitely appreciate Molly's kind words there and feedback, but that's something that I think for you and I, we're probably watching more of the global game also. And at the same time, too, with having access, and I mean, all of our listeners having more access to more leagues, more clubs, more competitions from around the world, there is so much to choose from. And I think just as our listeners are growing in terms of the leagues and clubs that they're interested in, I'm still finding interesting players and clubs and things that I probably didn't watch about 10 years ago. So it's been really enjoyable.
Yeah, thank you for that comment, Molly. And sorry we were a day late this week. We're doing this Thursday instead of Wednesday. On that note, Chris, what you just mentioned, that was what was so cool today about the Golazzo show on CBS, because I felt like I was learning about clubs and how they were doing this season outside the top five leagues. As I said earlier, Champions League, 15 of the 16 knockout stage participants, Porto is the one exception, come from the big five leagues. Last season, it was 16 out of 16, right? So today, got to see Eastern European clubs, got to see an Israeli team advance, got to see teams from Austria play and advance, got to see Rangers advance. So I kind of liked today for that reason. I felt like I was reconnecting with the global game. I've been trapped in this big five vortex of those top five leagues and got to appreciate the rest of continental football today. So I can definitely appreciate that sentiment, especially today.
Next up is Giovanni. And Giovanni has a fantastic question. If you were the MLS commissioner for one day, what would you fix to make the league better? And I'll go first, Carter, because I've had a little bit more time to think about this, probably about 5 seconds more than you. But I would say I would, day one, if I had one thing to change, is I would break up the single entity system. Because I think what it creates is very much a franchise model where new teams are added, but it's each team doesn't have a character. Each team doesn't have a lot of unique perspective. So, for example, I mean, going down the line as far as even just the kits that they wear, they're all wearing Adidas kits. You go down the line as far as the way the clubs are run, they all run very similar ways. As far as spending, I'd love to see some clubs, if there wasn't a single entity system, have some of the clubs have more autonomy to go ahead and kind of reach out to, you mean, the rest of the soccer fans in the United States and do things that MLS clubs right now are probably restricted from doing. So that's my hope, is that if I was MLS commissioner for one day, I would break up that system. Yes, there's benefits of it in terms of financial, but also it kind of reins in a lot of these clubs where it feels plastic. It doesn't feel as authentic, where you can have maybe a club just go on a spending spree and just buy some major players and actually kind of shake things up a little bit. What about you, Kartik? MLS commissioner for one day.
I think, breaking up single entity obviously would be my first priority as well, which you mentioned. So I'll give another one, which is shifting the calendar. I believe if you shift the calendar to a more European-style calendar, and I know people from Minnesota are going to get upset, and people from Seattle are going to get, people from Toronto. Of course, I will remind people that the folks that this is a U.S. Based league and a U.S. sanctioned league in Canada. At some point, should have their own first division with first division teams in that first division. Now the CanPL, which is effectively the equivalent of a U.S. second division, is a great start. But shifting the calendar, having a long winter break, right? Maybe even longer than Germany's, but being able to strategically take advantage of when youth soccer is playing. Youth soccer season is effectively on the Euro calendar. And that's when schools are in. And also, in terms of player development, I've learned the hard way from being in the sport in this country, how difficult it is to develop players if you're playing in the hottest months of the year, how difficult it is, how many times training gets scratched or you're training kind of at half speed or you curtail training sessions if you're a manager because of the weather in the middle of the summer. And also, quite frankly, and this is also pretty important, that the violent weather as the U.S. gets hotter, U.S. summers get hotter, the thunderstorm. So calendar change would be mine as a bonus in addition to your breaking up a single entity.
Okay, the next two comments are a little bit similar, so I'll go ahead and read both of them out. First one is from Aram, and he says, this past Sunday, after two legs, the Liga MX semi-final between Pumas and Cruz Azul ended 4-4 in aggregate. There was no extra time or shootout. Pumas advanced thanks to being the higher seed. I'm curious for your and Kartik's thoughts on whether this would be a good idea for the MLS single elimination playoff matches. Would certainly make the regular season way more important. And then John Average Geek says, would a league ever think about a modified point system? Some youth tournaments have it. Points for goal scoring, points for clean sheet, more points for wins, etc. Might be good for MLS with its unbalanced schedule. So you've got two, you mean kind of the unbalanced schedule, and then also Aram talking about kind of trying to make the regular season more interesting and adding some kind of a different type of system there as far as figuring out the teams that progress. What do you think, Kartik?
Yeah, I mentioned before on the show, I think that that to me makes the Liga MX regular season or tournaments, right, whether it's the Apertura or Clausura, more important, the single matches in those tournaments more important than in MLS, because you do get a benefit from being the higher seed if there is if matches are, or after two legs, if matches are level. So I definitely advocate that for MLS 100%. So Aram, thank you for that. As far as the modified points, no, the NASL did that, the old NASL. I think it's ridiculous, because there is a certain value to this is why I'm even kind of hedging on goal difference as a tiebreaker anymore. I kind of like the idea that Spain does head to head between teams as the first tiebreaker, and UEFA does too, right? Champions League, it's head to head and aggregate goals and head to head competition, because I think that discriminates against teams that are very well organized and are defensive and may win a lot of matches 1-0. Although you do save maybe points for clean sheets. But, MLS with its unbalanced schedule is I think that's why you have playoffs. Because I don't think that there's any reason to ever have a balanced schedule in MLS. I think it's madness to have teams flying over all over the country and playing for an LA team to play a team in Boston as much as they play the other team in LA. I think it's ridiculous. Just from a geographical standpoint, this isn't like one of the small countries in Western Europe where you can balance schedules. So you have to have playoffs because of that. But I don't want to kind of game the whole playoff system by giving a team that may have scored seven goals in one match a extra points. And then also, I think in terms of what the U.S. is trying to do as a soccer-playing nation, and we know we've had these discussions, right, with Alexi Lalas. Alexi Lalas seems to get angry now that we want that when people like I mention, and maybe rightly so, I mean, he's got his perspective, but that I mentioned that MLS was created to help the U.S. men's national team, and that and as long as there's an agreement where some is getting money from U.S. men's national team matches, that there should be some emphasis put on the men's national team and considerations for U.S. soccer. I will say U.S. soccer under Greg Berhalter is trying to develop a possession-based style of play, a more possession-based, more fluid attack style of play. And yeah, I know they scored however many goals they did against El Salvador in that meaningless friendly, but it would be good if MLS teams got up 1-0 in a match and then knew how to keep the ball. Mm-hmm. That would help U.S. soccer out a lot. So I actually do not want to encourage teams to just keep attacking and score goals and have all these uneven matches. I think it would actually be the wrong thing. Because as Bruce Arena pointed out when MLS started and all these kinds of suggestions came from the Lamar Hunts and the Phil Anschutzes of the world, which was to make bigger goals and maybe have the NASL points system. Bruce Arena, who was actually at the time not the U.S. men's national team coach, he was DC United's coach, but he was in tune with international football. He and Kevin Payne, who was his general manager or his president with DC United, put a stop to all that talk because basically Bruce Arena's like, look, my guys, our guys, U.S. guys have to compete in international football. Don't change the rules on them because then we're going to be at a disadvantage, competitive disadvantage. So I think that's the bottom line. You're putting the U.S. and whatever other internationals are in your league at a competitive disadvantage if you start messing with the rules like that.
Yeah, I agree. There's no reason to overcomplicate matters, and let's keep it simple. And I agree. Two final comments, and both of these are along similar lines too, so I'll read both of these out. First up is from Coolio Two Foots, and Coolio Two Foots says, watching the halftime talk on Peacock for Spurs and Arsenal, and I have to say Tim Howard needs to step up his game. Both of the two Robbies and Rebecca have been superb in their analysis and points. When I'm watching Tim Howard, it's like he's struggling to get his words out and not sure what to say. Michael F. says, I have to make a comment in relation to a earlier post you've made on NBC Sports' Premier League studio coverage not being as good this season in comparison to previous season. This is not a knock on Tim Howard as much as a compliment to the two Robbies, who are collectively so good at breaking down match analysis. The energy level with Rebecca Lowe was considerably better with Musto back with Earl and Lowe this weekend, and it's just quite honestly a significant upgrade. As a comparison, I always thought that the two Robbies are better than anything the ESPN FC regular studio crew guys can deliver on Premier League analysis, objective and informative. Yeah, and that's the thing, though, too, is that I think I agree. I think the two Robbies together are great. We haven't seen a lot of them this season together because with Tim Howard in and this kind of really inconsistent lineup in terms of how many people are in the studio. Is it two people? Is it three? And it's been rare that we've had four. So when we've had the two Robbies, I think it's worked well and it's clicked. And as you saw with Danny Higginbotham, he seemed to kind of was a much better fit than Tim Howard. Tim has, I think, good days and bad days, and his style is just not conducive, and it doesn't really fit well with the NBC Sports style. I mean, I think it just is not a good fit yet. All right, listeners, we want you to have your say. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. Don't forget, you can get your World Soccer Talk merchandise, including Enjoy Your Football t-shirts and hats, and actually polo shirts too. Just check out worldsoccertalk.com and then look for the button on the nav bar, on the navigation bar that says merch. And we've got lots of different things for you to choose from. And Kartik, before we head out of here, where can listeners find you on Twitter if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, KKFLA737. My DMs are open. Feel free to buzz me anytime.
All right, so Kartik's got the Madrid derby. I've got Chelsea against Everton, and there's a whole ton of games to watch this weekend. I mean, some really, really exciting matches from around the world. And Kartik, whether they're watching it in person, as we've seen now with a lot of fans coming back into stadiums, as well as or watching it on television or streaming, what are you going to do and what should they do?
Enjoy your football.